This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 16 for Thursday, July 16th, 2009, Soul Man. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outoflinedetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours Greenwich Mean Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line After Hours in the iTunes Music Store.
And it's great to be doing another show here Thursday night for Out of Line After Hours. Normally we have Peter DeLorenzo in the studio. He's not here tonight because Peter is up at Road America for some vintage car racing. I told him take a lot of pictures. And maybe we'll get some of those pictures on the show here next week. I'll bet you Peter's got them on his website. We also typically, if you haven't been watching a few shows, have Jason Vines. Jason, we lost. He got a real job. So people who get real jobs, we're losers for that. But joining us in the studio, David Welch from Business Week. Great having you here, David.
Evening, folks.
Yeah.
Great to be here.
And Scott Burgess from the Detroit News. Scott, great having you here.
It's good
too.
To be here. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we should have some fun.
No Jason Vines, but I'll try.
you can try to be Jason. And we also have Michael Sprague from Kia. Michael, thanks for joining us via Skype today.
Yeah, sure, no problem. Happy to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, and we've got a lot that we'll want to talk to you about Kia, but I wanted to get into some of the latest news that has come out this week. And one, I don't know if you guys noticed this, the Tata Nano passed the European crash standards for, I think it was offset and head-on, or was it side impact and head-on? And I was stunned by that news. I thought there's no way this thing would be able to crash European, much less U.S. standards.
Well, you and I know somebody who worked on that vehicle
right.
Very well. And I don't think
we can say his name, Sandy Monroe.
Sandy Monroe, Monroe and Associates.
Right here in the Detroit area, did a lot of engineering on the Tata Nano.
He had some Nanos up, in his big work area, and he's smart enough to at least convince them that they need to engineer that thing to be able to sell it in some other markets. Because even if they had to put more money into it to make it crash worthy in Europe or the U.S., as long as they've got the ability to do it, that suddenly that thing's a viable vehicle for any market, and it's that cheap. It's a real, it's a real threat.
To me, it's an eye opener. What did you think of that, Scott?
Well, I was surprised to hear that it did pass. You do wonder if it's strictly the engineering for the specific tests, and when it comes down to passenger safety, how safe those vehicles are going to be. But the success of the smart car, there's not been any really serious incidents with it.
The Smart's a $12,000 car base.
Yeah.
The Nano's $2,500, at least in India it is.
It would be more than that here.
Oh, yeah, I know.
But still, say it's $5,000 here and it's basic transportation. Somebody's going to buy the things. And, if it passes crash testing, that's big. Now, the smart car did too, and then it got pretty well ravaged a couple weeks ago for while passing, basically getting demolished when up against bigger SUVs. I can't remember who did that.
It was like IIHS, and it was like they slammed, wasn't it some SUV into it? And I said, slam a semi into the SUV and see what happens. So slam a train into the semi and see what happens.
I know what you're saying, and I agree with you, but people who buy a Nano or a Smart or a Mini sort of know what they're up against. That said, there are enough people out there who are going to see something like that and say, forget it. Look, I bought a Mini in 2003. I have a Cooper S. British Racing Green. It's gorgeous. And I still have friends who say, how can you drive that? Oh, it's cramped inside. It's not. It's not safe. It's got a 4-star crash rating. It's got to be a dog. It goes like a scalded dog. But I still get these comments. I've had the car for 6 years, and people just don't get why would you buy that thing. And,
it's got the crash protection safety, certainly for the two front seat passengers of a BMW 3 Series.
Yeah, BMW engineered that. And from what I understand, they actually sacrificed a fair amount of cabin space to be able to engineer the fold and crash systems that keep the driver and occupants from getting crushed. I mean, they made some compromises, but you have to. But still, you know, it's just the image of it. And then if you've got, you know, this thing with smart, I think the New York Times ran a big story on it. You know, someone's going to get scared away from it. But
the very first thing when smart arrived, it was a presentation on how safe that vehicle was. When you talked about smart, the first thing out of everybody's mouth was, this is a safe vehicle. It's, you know, that they had the safety cell right there for you to look at, and they had footage of it getting smashed up. And, you know, Tata's going to have to approach it exactly the same way, that this is a safe car, that you are not going to die if you get in this car.
Let's ask Michael Sprague, because Kia, you know, is such an entry-level brand, at least right now it is, and maybe we'll learn more about that. But, Michael, what do you think about something like the Tata Nano coming into the American market?
Yeah, sure. Anytime a new competitor comes into the marketplace, regardless of where they're positioning it, you know, it's something to be concerned with. So we'll keep an eye on it and see what happens.
What do you think of the kind of price point that a Nano might open up? I mean, let's say they double the price. Let's say it's $5,000 in the American market. It'd still be an incredible price.
Absolutely. And you're right. You said earlier on, there will be people that will buy it just based purely on that price.
Yeah. Some more news this week, Scott, that we learned about. Now looks like the G8 is going to live. You know, they had been talking about maybe an Impala SS, and GM said, no. Now they're saying maybe they'd bring the Pontiac G8 in as a Chevy Caprice.
I was able to talk to Fritz Henderson on Tuesday.
About that.
Specifically asked him, and he said no. Bob Lutz on Monday had come out and said that, and now Bob Lutz has a thing on GM blogs now that says, if I had a Wayback Machine and could go back to Monday, what I meant to say was that currently it's not an affordable option for us, and it's not coming back, is it?
Okay, that makes more sense. Because, you know, 2 weeks ago we had Mark LaNave here, and LaNave said the same thing that Fritz told you ain't going to happen.
Well, I wrote the story.
That it was going to happen?
Well, I wrote the story that they're mulling it over, and that Bob came up with the idea. In the same story, because I interviewed Ray Young that day, he's the CFO of the company, I asked him, are you going to do this? Is it affordable? How good is the business case for bringing cars out of Australia? And he said, look, you know, initially we turned it down and we said no way, and that's where it stands right now. If Bob wants to do it, you know, he's back in the seat. We're going to listen to him. And it basically was an idea of Bob's. And what my story said, you know, these things are, you know, they take on a life of their own. What my story said is, you know, GM is mulling over whether or not to bring the Caprice. And they are, / were. It's still a possibility. Bob still has an ear for doing it. I've been told also they're considering it for the police car market.
Right.
And the taxi cab market, that, selling it as fleet only.
Fritz Henderson did say that there were certainly a good case to make it a fleet vehicle for police and such.
So are they telling us one thing, knowing that the task force is listening, and the task force is the one who told them, kill Pontiac? And now maybe you say...
You know what I think? I mean, look, having talked to all the players involved in this thing, here's what I think is happening is the G8, cool rear-drive sports car, it got a great reception, pretty good pricing and volume for a Pontiac during its short life. Buff Book guys loved it. It actually got, I mean, when's the last time the Pontiac brand got any kind of good buzz? I mean, the G8, and it really is a terrific car. I know people who drive BMWs who told me that they were considering buying a G8. Bob looks at that and says, you know, let's at least look at this. And that's, you know, that's right in his sweet spot. He loves sporty cars, particularly sporty sedans. The guy used to work for BMW. So he says, you know, let's do some exercises here. They sell the thing as a Caprice in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. And they, as a Chevy Caprice.
Yes.
Yep.
Now, that car doesn't pass U.S. It's either front or rear end crash standards. So they'd have to, I think it's front end, because they'd have to redo the fascia. I was told it would take like a year to take the Middle Eastern Caprice, or even just take a G8, restyle the front end, because you have to do different blow-molded plastics for the front, you know, the whole front end. You know, you got to crash it again. From what I understand, anyways, it's more than just slapping a new grill on it and bringing it over here. So it would take some time, but you know that they did consider doing it, and you know, and they're still sort of looking at it. It's not a huge priority for the company, because even under Chevy, it's not going to do a ton of volume. But it's one of these things where I think when Bob was an advisor, someone brought, I know people in GM design brought up the idea of making it a Chevy, and it was turned down. Bob likes the car. Bob says, you know, let's look at this. And, you know, before he's had a chance to, you know, officially propose it, Ray Young and Fritz Henderson say, no, there's no plan to do it. Fine. You know, maybe Bob tees it up and it doesn't happen. Maybe it does. Maybe it takes some time to get it done. You know, but they're definitely talking about it. And I know what I heard.
Well, they should. they should talk about it because it's a great car.
And it is a terrific car.
You know, whether it's going to be a Chevy. I mean, there's been people that have called to ask what car should they buy. And you're like, go buy a G8 right now. They're giving them away. You can get a good deal on it. And that GXP, I think, is a phenomenal car for the money.
Yeah.
And even the six-cylinder with the 3.6 is a really nice car. And it just seemed to be that there's a little bit of a, I don't know, it'll be interesting to see how the relationship between Fritz and Bob works out and how different that was between Rick Wagner and Bob Lutz. So.
And another car that we learned this week, too, the Vipers, not going away. They're reviving that. What do you make of that, Scott?
Good for them.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the SRT team at Dodge or at Chrysler, it makes money. You know, at the end of the day, there are some vehicles that I think that that's kind of a poster child for overindulgence, but it's still a great car to drive.
Well, look, if there's one thing that I think, and it's all Chrysler's fault, but if there's one thing Chrysler lost under Cerberus, it was they sort of lost the company's soul.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the swagger? Where are the cool sports cars? The designs got garish. They cut back a lot of new products, so you didn't have that buzz of some new cool Chrysler. You didn't even have Chrysler used to be, and you guys will know this, the company that all the big auto shows that had the coolest concepts. And you went to their press conferences to see what they were going to do next, not only in terms of the cars themselves, but the theatrics that they might have. And then, you know, suddenly you've got, you know, three electric cars and, you know, Jim Press sort of saying, well, you know, we're going to make one of these. Maybe we'll make three of these. And, you know, it didn't have that sort of really grip you kind of buzz. And they weren't the cool concept company anymore. I mean, they sort of lost all of that. And if they're going to bring this thing back, yeah. More power to them.
Was interesting is during the bankruptcy hearings, they were asked, hey, how come you haven't sold off Viper? And they said, well, nobody wanted to buy it. And then two investment groups came up and said, wait a minute, we wanted to buy it. And we put in bids on this thing.
I've heard of at least one.
And then they said, oh, well, they didn't put in enough money. We couldn't get anything over $10 million. And then I can't remember which group it was, says, wait a minute, we offered you guys $35 million for it.
Right.
And then,
by the way, those Indiana pension funds put that in their legal documents.
Right.
I mean, now, they were trying to make the case that the breakup scenario on Chrysler I think, what was it, $800 million for the whole company was inaccurate. And they said, you know, just look at the value of the Viper franchise. We found a bidder who will pay more than you guys valued it at. So already your case is unraveling. Now, they didn't have the rest of the facts going brand by brand through the rest of the company to make the case. But, you know, I remember hearing that at the time, that, you know, that somebody had actually shown some interest. Now, did they put an official bid together? Did they have the money? Did they have financial backing? You know, I don't know.
Yeah, they did, because I know one of the guys involved in it, Dave Draper, who used to run Cars and Concepts. He's the one who said that they offered $35 million
really?
For it. Yeah, absolutely. And but here's my thinking all along is Chrysler thought, you know, this is nuts. To your point, Scott, we make money on this car. This is a great halo brand for Dodge, or halo car for the Dodge brand. You know, let's just see if we can get away with not killing this thing. They come out of bankruptcy and kabah, you know, ta-da, they announced they're going to keep the car. I think this was kind of the plan all along.
Is there PR crafty enough to do that? I mean, you know, they pretty much lay low in the weeds. I mean, and I think that's one of the problems they're going to have is they're out of bankruptcy. They got out before GM. They have to make a case that they've got cool cars. They're going to sell something, that the company's back. You don't hear anything from these guys.
Right.
I mean, I know Fiat and the Italians have to get their arms around this whole thing and figure out what they're going to do. But, you know, Chrysler has just been, they're too quiet for a company that is trying to make a comeback in part on taxpayers' dollars.
Mm-hmm.
You got to start shouting from the rooftops that you're back in business and you've got cool cars to sell, and you have cool cars, very important, you have cool cars coming because, remember, they canceled an event on future product.
Right. Let's get Michael Sprague in on this, Michael, because I'm driving one of your cool cars right now. I'm test driving a Kia Soul right now. How important is it to have quote-unquote cool cars in your lineup?
Yeah, absolutely. For us, it's very important. And the Soul is being positioned as kind of that halo vehicle for us. You know, we're trying to transform our brand, and this is kind of the first vehicle that's really signaling the direction that we want to take it. And it's, you know, more fun, more youthful, more sporty. You know, after the Soul, we followed it up with the Forte, and then the Forte Coupe comes out later this year.
So you guys are really going strong on small cars right now. I know everyone in Washington is saying, oh, you got to build small cars, get good fuel economy and all, but are they the right car for the market right now?
Right. With gas prices stabilizing, at least out here in California, just under $3 a gallon, there is a lot of that question. You know, a year ago, we saw a huge demand for small cars. We're definitely not seeing that now like we did a year ago. We are still seeing people buy, you know, SUVs and crossovers. I mean, our Sportage sales have been up. Our Sedona sales have been up. Borrego continues to improve, which we launched just last year. So, for us, I mean, we're building small cars and introducing them right now, but we're also freshening all of our product to the point by 2011, the Borrego will be our oldest product in the showroom. So we're not just looking at the small cars. We know customers want other things.
Michael, do you make money on every car that you sell? When you're selling, I mean, the Forte is very moderately priced and it's nicely loaded. The Soul starts at around 13.3. I mean, one of the complaints you hear over here is that there's no money to be made in small cars.
Right. And I can't answer that specifically, but I can say by being a global company and having the efficiencies of, you know, the Soul and the Forte and a number of our other products going around the world, you know, we're able to get the scale, get the, you know, the cost out through the volume. So I'd say, yeah, or else we wouldn't be in this business.
Michael, David Welch with Business Week here. How's it going?
Good.
You've got a small car out. Mazda 3 is pretty new. You've got in the next, 18 months, I think we've got Focus, Fiesta, Chevy Cruze,
Spark.
The Spark. A lot of compact and subcompact cars coming to market. And yet, you know, you're telling us they aren't selling like they were a while ago because, you know, fuel prices aren't exactly cooperating. Talk about the landscape here for small cars. You know, you have a lot of competition coming in the next 18 months, and gas prices aren't necessarily pushing people in that direction. So what's going to happen with pricing and volume and incentives? Are we going to have a big cage match in the small car market the next year or so?
Well, you're right. There's a lot of formidable competition coming. What we've seen in terms of fuel prices, according to NHTSA and the EPA and all of the other third-party sources that we look at, gas prices are expected to actually go back up. It looks like around $3.50. We think that will, once it goes back over $3, we'll start to see more interest in small cars. We're also seeing, you know, people that do want to downsize. You know, they couldn't get out of their vehicles a year ago, but perhaps maybe now when they can get out of them, because either they were upside down or their leases hadn't come due yet or whatever, you know, for whatever reasons, you know, people are realizing maybe they don't need the big cars that they had in the past. And yet they still want, you know, the space and the fuel economy and, you know, the great technology and great design. And I think we'll see some customers actually move into the small cars.
Michael, are you still getting mileage out of the hamsters?
Yeah, exactly. The hamsters. Yeah, we've gotten a lot of questions of why we didn't launch the Forte using the hamsters. a number of reasons. One, the Forte buyer is much more rational than the Soul buyer was. We were really trying to connect with, you know, a younger customer that we needed to speak to more of an emotional level than a rational level. But the hamsters continue. I mean, if you go out to YouTube, we've had over 850,000 hits on YouTube of people just watching the commercial. It did very well in various awards. So, yeah, we're going to continue to leverage it in different ways.
And the hamsters on the running wheel signify what, if people are looking for deeper meaning?
Yeah, it was really to signify that there's a lot of vehicles out there that kind of look the same. People are kind of in this rut, you know, doing the same thing day in and day out. That's what the hamster on the wheel signifies. And then along comes this, you know, this new vehicle that's really cool looking, and it's got a lot of great technology and great safety, great quality. And, you know, hey, this is a new way to get about. It's a new way to roll, as like the tagline says.
Michael, would you ever consider a hamster as a hood ornament in the way that Jaguar has the Leaper?
You hadn't thought of that one, had you?
It's funny. We had no idea that the hamsters would kind of take on a life of their own. They really have just become somewhat iconic to the brand. And, it's, you know, it's, as a marketer, it's like, you know, that's great because people recognize it and make the association with the brand. But at the same time, I don't necessarily want to, you know, to have it as, you know, my brand icon.
To get back to one point you had made, that it, has anybody had a $13,000 Halo vehicle before?
Well, I guess maybe if you look back to the, you know, 60s, 70s, and early 80s, you could say, yeah, the Mustang at one point was $13,000.
But you understand what I'm saying? Is it's yeah. Price-wise, it's on the lower side, but...
It is on the lower side. I mean, for us, it's what we have to work with. It's, mm-hmm. As I said earlier, it's the first vehicle in, you know, our product-led transformation. Who's not to say that there might be something else, you know, in the near future?
Wasn't the 57 to 59 Eldorado Brougham priced at 13 and it was just under a Rolls? I think that literally was.
I think you're right, but I think Scott's talking about $13,000 in today's dollars.
Today's
got a bad time and also trying to impress people with my knowledge of 50s automobile pricing.
Michael, what is the Kia brand? I mean, what does this thing stand for? How would you describe it?
Well, you know, we entered the marketplace 15 years ago, and we were really considered, you know, a cheap brand with a great warranty. With the new product, like I said, we are trying to kind of reposition ourselves to be more sporty, more youthful, more dynamic. We want to establish a better relationship with our customers, be perceived as more trustworthy. And that's by making sure that we deliver great vehicles with great quality, great design, great safety, great technology. You know, it's moving away from that cheapness to say, hey, we are a value brand with all of these great attributes.
One of our readers, knowing that you were going to be, or viewers, knowing that you're going to be on the show today, wrote in saying, how can your company battle the perception that many people still have that Kia cars are cheap and unreliable, inferior cars compared to Japanese brands?
That's a great question, and it's something that we struggle with every day because the perception out there is exactly as your reader wrote, that it is, you know, a cheap car. But so we have to, you know, make sure that consumers are aware that Consumer Reports ranks us in the top 10 in terms of vehicle quality. J.D. Power, you know, we've made more improvements over the last 8 years than any other brand in terms of the rankings. We know that the perception versus the reality, there's about a 3 to 5 year gap. We need to communicate through our product messaging, make sure that, you know, in our advertising, we're representing the vehicle, showing it in its best light, high quality, confident tone, call out how the features and benefits can relate to the customer and fit their needs. We just need to continue to kind of reinforce our story over and over and over again.
So just keep hammering at it and let time take its course.
Yeah, exactly. And hopefully with vehicles like the Soul and the Forte and the Forte Coupe, I mean, you guys all know in this business, it's all about the product. And if you come out with really great designed product, hopefully that shortens that perception gap. And we are seeing, you know, customers that we hadn't seen before come in on the Soul and the Forte as well. So, you know, hopefully the product is going to change that perception.
Michael, you're also, Kia is very aggressive right now with its advertising, isn't it?
It depends on how you define aggressive.
You're spending money to get the word out about the Soul and about the Forte.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when we put our business plan together last fall, set out the strategy from a marketing communication standpoint. We looked at, you know, January and February particularly when OEMs traditionally kind of pull back from an advertising standpoint. We said, you know what, there are still consumers that are in the marketplace in January and February. Let's continue to advertise, not pull back. It just, you know, reinforce that, hey, we're here. We've got great new products. And just keep, as I mentioned, just keep hammering it. You know, not everybody's in the market right now to buy a vehicle, but hey, hopefully they're going to, when they do come back into the market, say, you know what, I remember seeing a Kia ad 3 months, 6 months ago. I'm going to go check them out. I'm going to, you know, go on, you know, Kia.com and see what they're all about. We just, you know, in these difficult economic times, it's like we're not going to let up.
And you're a sponsor of the NBA?
Yeah, we're the official partner, automotive partner to the NBA. We just finished our second season. We also have 16 partnerships with individual teams. So we've got the overarching NBA league and then the 16 teams. In the quarterfinals, there was Cleveland, Miami, Orlando, and LA, and we had partnerships with three of the four semifinalists. And with that association, it helps elevate our brand because people look at us differently of being, you know, wow, they're, you know, they've elevated themselves to be a partner with, you know, a pretty strong brand. I mean, the NBA is just, you know, a phenomenal brand. And this past year, their ratings were up 14%. So it's been a good sponsorship.
Michael, talk about the brand association between Kia and the NBA. I mean, they almost sort of seem like, maybe divergent or very, very different kinds of brands. I mean, look, NBA is a great lead to get in front of the fans. But, you know, what's the connection there? Why did you guys pick NBA over maybe some of the sports?
Yeah, we looked at the demographic of who they were attracting. We also looked at, where the teams were located. Our data shows that we do very well in kind of suburban and rural markets. We don't do well kind of in the top 20 urban markets. So it was part of our long-term strategy of how do we kind of start to break into those markets. And again, it looked like a partnership. They were growing. We wanted to grow, and it just felt like it was the right sort of partnership.
But your newest cars, the Forte and the Soul, aren't most of the NBA players too tall to get in these cars?
Well, sure, the players are. It's the fans that we're going out.
I know, I'm giving you a hard time.
I know.
We've got the
Borrego, which they can fit in, and if they have families, they've got the Sedona as well. And of course, if they've got kids, you know, we've got the Rio and the Soul and the Forte Coupe and the Forte. We've got something for everybody.
Hey. Kia's on a roll right now. Global sales. I mean, sales are down in the U.S., but not that much. And globally, I thought I just read that your sales are up. Why the success? I mean, why not the kind of collapse with other brands we've seen in this market? And why is Kia doing so well globally?
Well, I think it goes back to kind of a similar strategy that we're taking here in the U.S. is, you know, when there is crises, you know, take the opportunity and seize it and go forward. And we, you know, didn't hold back on any of our new product launches, you know, like some other companies did. We said, you know, we've got this product coming. Let's just keep going. And I know Europe did that with the Soul. You know, it's doing very well there. I think everybody is doing well in China. So that's helping us as well. But again, as you guys know, it all comes down to the product, and we are on this cadence of introducing new product continuously over the next couple of years.
So does the Kia brand get a hybrid at some point? I see in Korea, Hyundai and Kia have just come out with hybrids that run on LPG.
Yeah, it's... you know, obviously, I can't say officially whether or not we're going to get it, but let me tell it to you this way. You know, when we came into the marketplace, you know, our quality was not that good. We went and fixed the quality, and that's evidenced by some of the results that we're seeing now. We wanted to focus on safety, and we've got some of the safest vehicles through IIHS testing and through NHTSA testing. Then we looked at technology and said, you know what? As more and more consumers are adapting to mobile technology and PDAs and iPods and things like that, we want technology in our vehicles that you know, are going to be useful to their everyday lives. So we started to put a lot of that into our vehicles, particularly Soul and Forte Coupe. And then it became design. Okay, we're making some progress here, but now let's get away from this kind of cheap EconoBox image and let's come out with some really great designed products and start to have a consistent design DNA in our products. And so about 3 years ago, we hired Peter Schreier out of Audi. And with the Soul and the Forte and the Coupe, you're really starting to see his design direction. So if you think of all those things, quality, safety, technology, design, what else can we do to really make our vehicles, you know, some of the best in the marketplace? And that's powertrains. And so I think you'll see over the next couple of years a concerted effort on our side to, you know, to fix that. And that could potentially include hybrid technology. So kind of a long answer to your question, but there is a story behind it.
Gotcha. Yeah. And boy, I think Peter Schreiber, did you say his name is?
Schreier.
Yeah. He's doing a terrific job.
He is. And he's just a great guy to work with. He's a lot of fun.
The first time I saw the photos of the Forte, I was really impressed. And in fact, if I were Honda, I'd be worried about how strong you guys are coming on. In fact, this is what I want to ask you. It almost seems to me like Kia's mission is go kill Honda. And Hyundai's mission is go kill Toyota.
I mean, clearly, you know, as a challenger brand in the marketplace, I mean, we do need to set our sights on, you know, the competition that's leading the industry. And, you know, right now it's the Hondas and the Toyotas and the Nissans. So I wouldn't say there's one particular brand that we've you know, said this is who we want to go after. But I think it's pretty safe assumption to say we've got our sights on the leaders.
Well, it looks right now, Michael, that by the end of this year, Kia Hyundai will be the number six automaker or seller of cars in the U.S. You're ahead of Nissan right now, and there's no reason to suspect that that's going to change.
Right. Hopefully not. Particularly with, I mean, the Forte launch just now kind of starting up. We don't see that changing.
Michael, as you guys grow, how do you keep from bumping into Hyundai as you expand the product line in terms of brand image, in terms of product offering and that sort of thing? How do you keep from not just sort of cannibalizing each other as you start to get bigger?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's something that we try to work with our colleagues back in Seoul on all the time. And in any brand, you know, where there's two within the family, you know, Ford, Lincoln, Mercury, or the GM brands or the Chrysler brands, you know, even the Toyotas and the Hondas, you know, we look at them and try to learn from their mistakes. And at the end of the day, it's it comes down to the product, to the design, that they've got to be differentiated. There can't be, at least on what the consumer sees, any similarities or, you know, it's too important. They've got to be differentiated.
Hey, you haven't been at Kia very long, right? How long have you been there?
Almost a year. It'll be a year August 1st.
And then before that, you were at Ford, is that right?
Yep. Yep, 12 years at Ford in a number of sales and marketing roles, and actually spent about a year and a half at Mazda over in Hiroshima, which was just a phenomenal experience. And I think really what prepared me well for, you know, working with Koreans.
And what all did you work on it for, in addition to the Mazda assignment?
I was the Lincoln Mercury region back in Washington, D.C., Memphis region in with Lincoln Mercury. I was out here when, remember, PAG was out here. I was part of Lincoln Mercury back then. I was the Cougar Tracer Mystique brand manager. That's then when I went over to Mazda, then went back to Dearborn, worked in product marketing, was in the chief marketing office when Hans Olaf Olsen was leading it. And then my last role was in Lincoln Mercury. I was the kind of the general marketing manager for the Lincoln Mercury products and had responsibility for the launch of the MKS.
So a lot of automotive experience.
Yeah, in fact, I'm from Flint, right outside of Flint. My grandparents worked in the plants. My grandfather was part of the great sit-down strike. Both of my parents worked in companies affiliated with automotive. So it's pretty much been in my blood. I left it for a little while. I was working at Arthur Andersen, the old accounting and consulting firm, but then somehow ended up back in automotive. It's, you guys know, once it's in your blood, you can't get it out.
No, that's so true. It's a lot of people who think they're going to leave the industry end up coming back to it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the complexity and just what drives people to make their purchase decisions. And, everybody has a story about a vehicle. You guys were talking about the Chevy Caprice earlier on, and it just brought a smile to my face because my first vehicle was a hand-me-down. It was a 78 Chevy Caprice Classic. So, everybody's got their story.
Right.
It's not as sexy as, a 65 Mustang or something like that. I had the old Chevy Caprice. Had a big back seat, though.
Hey, Michael, you've got some serious automotive heritage from what you were just telling us. And now you're working for the upstart Korean company that's taken a lot of buyers away from the domestics. What's how does that tug at the heartstrings for you when, looking back, you're a Flint guy.
Right.
Talk about that a bit.
Yeah, at first, when I told my parents and grandparents I was going to work for Ford and not for GM, it was like, what do you mean? We're a GM family.
So I bet Kia went over really well.
Yeah. Well, I think everybody realizing that the world is a much different place and that, it's a global economy these days. They were fine with it. And I get, living in Southern California, my family gets to a great place to vacation in January, February, or March. So that kind of, once I told them that, everything was okay.
So Hyundai's got this Equus coming. Is there an expensive sedan or cool sports car, high-end, in Kia's future that's going to show us that the brand has arrived? Is there a Kia Countach coming or something like that?
I'll be honest, we study the market all the time. We look at some of the products that are available in other Kia products that are available in other markets around the world and say, is this right for our brand right now? In the near term, I would say, no, something like that isn't right for our brand. Ask me that question in 5 years after we've, gone through this complete product-led transformation, and hopefully we see our sales and share continue to increase and, the type of buyer coming in and buying our products better than where we're at right now. Then I might say, yeah, we're ready to go there. But right now, no, we're not.
Well, real good. Michael, we're going to move on to the next segment of the show, but it's been terrific having you on here with us on AutoLine After Hours. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
No problem. I appreciate the opportunity to tell the Kia story, and anytime you want to talk, let me know.
Real good. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Michael.
And we probably need to get our rapid fire list out here at this point. And while they're getting that together, maybe what we should do is our GM bankruptcy contest, announce the winner of that. We've got some great prizes here, an AutoLine hat with a 10-year commemorative pin, a DVD
a T-shirt that says Autoline on it, and also Peter DeLorenzo's Auto Extremist T-shirt. Coming to the winners of that, we decided we were going to have a contest to see who could guess how long GM was going to be in bankruptcy, because all the experts were saying it could take months, if not years. So I guessed a stab in the dark that it was going to take 75 days to get through bankruptcy. Peter DeLorenzo guessed 77 days. Jason Vines went with 120, but we were talking about that before. We're calling it at 40 days because, as we announced for the contest, it started June 1st, 30 days in June, and they came out on July 10th, so that's 40 days. And so we've got two winners here, Chris Bachman and Kevin Mayer. Oh, I've got an envelope. Oh,
it's under the cheeseburger.
It's under the cheeseburger that the dog wants. The grand prize winners are Kevin Mayer of South Amboy, New Jersey, and Chris Bachman of Columbus, Indiana. Congratulations, guys. And there was a big discussion here. Do we split the prizes in half and give them each half?
Half a T-shirt.
And it's like, no, we'll double all the prizes. And then we've got some runners up, too. And I don't know if we're going to give them anything, but Scott Klunk of New Oxford, Pennsylvania. Scott Klunk, New Oxford, Pennsylvania. Good job.
What did he guess?
Oh, he guessed Scott was at 37 days and tied with Gary Neal of Birmingham, Michigan, also at 37 days. And then, I mean, pretty impressive. I mean, there was a lot of people who got this a whole lot better than
I'd like to know from these guys why they picked, you know, under 50 days, because I didn't do it here on the show, but I personally was saying, you know, it was roughly a 3-month affair.
90 days.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I thought 90 days, and I thought, well, you know, it sounds like it's going faster. I'll really stick my neck out here and say it's only going to be 75.
I just thought we were going to get more fighting from creditors and you know, some of these plaintiffs groups that were rattling the saber before they even went in, you know, during the, you know, over the Chrysler bankruptcy. I thought we were going to see some real opposition from them. And you know, the courts, even if they don't have a case, the courts have to give them their time to make their case and everything like that. But, you know,
GM says that just so many things fell into place, were coincidental on the dates that when the judge was going to rule, that they had even expected it to go until the very end of July. But, you know, they were prepared for the 31st, I think, when it was going smoothly. So,
yeah, you know, at the press conference, when Fritz Henderson was talking about the managerial changes, he even said he didn't expect to, you know, they were going to announce all of this when they got out of bankruptcy. He said something to the effect of he didn't expect it to be done so quickly, so he wasn't even ready with all the management changes. And I think it was when we asked him, you know, who's staying and who's going, and he said, well, you know, there'll be news coming, but he wasn't even ready for it. I imagine their attorneys were caught by surprise.
I think everybody was caught by surprise. And, you know, when people have asked me, you know, how was it possible this bankruptcy went so fast? My answer is easy. No other bankruptcy has had the White House saying, make it so. And when you've got the President of the United States saying, get this stuff done, it got done.
Yeah, and, you know, when I was told by one very prominent bankruptcy attorney who wasn't involved in the case, but, you know, he's a name people in that arena would recognize, the courts sort of compete for cases. And to get the cases, you sort of have to be a favorable venue. And, you know, I'm not going to say that they got, you know, treatment that was, you know, outside the law or anything, but, you know, it's clear that they were given a pretty favorable treatment in bankruptcy in terms of, you know, late night hearings and this sort of thing, really getting it done to expedite the whole thing.
Looks like we got the rapid fire questions, so. All right, it's time for rapid fire.
Okay, here we go.
Our favorite part of the show. Remember that you can call us in with a question or a comment, 1-620-288-6546. And in fact, we've got a phone question from Mike Western. Ben, can we bring that up?
My question is, what's Chevrolet going to do to compete with the new Ford Taurus? It looks like this new Taurus is got everything together, and Chevrolet is left behind. Thanks.
Great question, Mike. Great question.
What is Ford going to do, or what's Chevy going to do to combat the Taurus?
Well, it's not going to be the Caprice, I guess. You know, they're.
I thought we solved that earlier. It is going to be the Caprice.
Only for the cops.
Yeah.
They're going to have to do something with Impala. I mean, the Impala now is not a bad car, but it's very long in tooth, and they're going to have to do something to spruce that up. It was sort of boring when they first refreshed the car. Pretty nice car, pretty good value for the money, but they've got to do something with it stylistically. It's just tired and faded at this point.
Scott?
Well, obviously, the Impala needs the most of the work. They need. I mean, it would be great if they could have the success that they had with the Malibu when it came out. It's going to have to be something that can either beat it in the mileage. It would be nice to see one of these large sedans with over 20 miles per gallon in the city to really boost that mileage up. GM may have the potential to do that with that 3-liter that they're using, having just driven the LaCrosse. Something of the LaCrosse would be a nice version of the Impala. But I really like the Taurus. The only downside of the Taurus is that it moves up really quickly in its price, and so at $35,000, what else can you buy?
You get a lot of cars.
Oh, it's rapid fire. Sorry.
Yeah, rapid fire. We need fast answers here. Okay. Ride with Wes on Twitter asks, should Mitsubishi and Suzuki stay in the American market or go away?
I think there's room for Suzuki. I think it's a really well-run company, although they're not doing very well here. Mitsubishi, you know, I've said this before, and this is going to probably get me some calls, but this is one of these companies in the world that should have gone away completely in this crisis. I just don't see the unique proposition in terms of design or technology or brand or anything like that really makes them a unique company that we have to keep.
Andy Muldero asks, how could Jason get a job at a Christian publisher?
Oof. Well, I don't know.
I think that's all the answer that we need. Okay, Joseph asks, last week, Steve Hill told Forbes magazine that Cadillac had closed almost two-thirds of its dealerships. The closures were almost all rural dealerships, and Cadillac still has plans to launch a model smaller and cheaper than the CTS. Questions, comments, or reaction?
They will launch something smaller than the CTS, but it's not in the next year. It'll be in the next couple of years.
I think it's 2000. Actually, I had lunch with Steve Hill today. It's 2011 or 12. I think it's 2011. It's a 2012 model, actually.
Mm-hmm. Calendar year.
Yeah. And I don't, two-thirds of their dealerships? That doesn't sound right.
Yeah, they went from 1,400 to 500 something.
Holy moly. Yeah. Wow.
That's right.
Okay, I just learned something on my own show.
Okay. There's a reason you brought me on.
Yeah. Jim Schultz says, maybe you guys could comment tonight on this article from cars.com that, we'd have to read that. Well, it says, it discusses the percentage of American versus imported components found in today's vehicles. He says it's getting harder and harder to know what's an American car. What's an American car, Scott?
It is harder to tell what an American car is. Is the Honda Element, as compared to the Fusion, one built in Mexico, which is the Fusion Element, it's built in Ohio. The component list is even trickier, depending on where it's shipped from, and especially with NAFTA, I think that makes it a little trickier. And you know, the all American muscle car, the Camaro, is built in Canada.
Right. My definition is, where was most of the design, engineering, and development done?
Exactly.
Not where they bolted it together. The real value to any economy or country comes from
the intellectual property.
Right. So it's design, engineering, development, manufacturing, engineering.
Where did the profits go?
And the profits, but, you know, to me, the real value in having an auto industry is getting that development work done in your country. Okay, Dick Clary asks.
Oh, like iPods are made in China, you know, but that's an American product.
But it was all designed here, right.
Exactly.
Okay, Dick Clary asks, why aren't jingles used in car commercials anymore? Chevy, Buick, Ford, Toyota, Datsun all had snappy, memorable jingles over the years. Why not?
Because that's sort of dated and very pat advertising.
Taglines are still there. Just
that
not
they
music.
Are. Okay, Lionel Gilbertross asks, has anyone had any driving time in the new Buick LaCrosse? Yes, as a matter of fact, this afternoon I was driving the new LaCrosse. If so, how is it? And how's the styling look up close? It looks sort of weird in pictures. What do you think, Scott?
I drove it Tuesday. I really like the exterior, and I think the interior is very comfortable. It's overall a really nice ride.
And Dave, have you?
I haven't driven yet.
I'm not sold on the exterior styling. I think this is a car that is color sensitive. There's a real dark blue version, which I think looks sensational. In lighter colors, not so much. But the interior I liked a lot, and the driving dynamics of the car, absolutely world class. They got something there. Sam, I can't read this. I'm just going to butcher it. He's asking about the difference between Kia and Hyundai, and actually Mike Sprague just answered that. So Ronald Wright asks, with Michigan losing so many jobs in the auto industry, can it really become a player in the alternative fuel and battery hybrid industry? What's Michigan doing right and wrong to get there?
It's a pretty good question. Probably better for a segment other than rapid fire, but Michigan can become a player. Is it going to become the player? It's a bit hard to envision. I mean, I think you're going to have a lot of technology companies, think tanks, universities on the West Coast, and also sort of, the Boston area where you've got some venture cap and some good, MIT and other schools like that. And I think that's the advantage those areas have, are really strong technical schools, and they're going to get into this. I mean, University of Michigan, as we had Ms. Sastry here last week talking about, they've got a good program going, and there's a hotbed of engineering talent here that can take a role in that. But I think the coasts will give Michigan a run for its money.
Yeah. Okay, Pedro Fernandez asks, can Chevy turn a profit by building the Cruze here?
I don't know. I don't know how much or if any of a profit Ford gets for the Focus that it builds here.
No, I think they'll make profits. I think these guys slashing their labor costs, getting rid of all these overheads and legacy costs that they had, I think they can make a profit selling small cars in America, building small cars in America.
I think they can in the case of the Cruze, and here's why. It's going to have 40 mpg on the highway, which is a good story. It's bigger than the current Cobalt, I think significantly bigger. So they may be able to get some premium pricing on it, and that's what they're trying to do is move it upscale. And over time, you're going to have more of those $14-an-hour workers coming in on the second tier of wage of the labor contract. So you're not looking at guys who cost, $70 an hour. You're looking at, I think the all-in cost is $28 for those new hires. So, you throw all that together, they can make money on it. If one of those doesn't work, it'll be more challenging.
Okay. Elke Meowmers asks, Great Caesar's Ghost, why is Mazda in talks with Toyota to get hybrid technology? Why not use Ford's?
Run the question by me again.
Why is Mazda in talk with Toyota to get hybrid technology? Why not use Ford's hybrid technology? That's a story that we carried on today's show, and it's a great question. My only guess is Ford sold half of its holdings in Mazda. It no longer has operational control of the company. Mazda's free to do what it wants. Maybe it's uncertain of hitching its wagon to Ford on hybrid technology.
Yeah, and even though Ford has done, certainly of the domestics pretty well with hybrids, Toyota's still the leader in technology. They've got a lot more volume, so maybe they can give Mazda a better deal on it because they're amortizing the cost over a lot of Priuses and other hybrids already. Those are my guesses. I haven't seen the proposal, but it makes sense to me.
Ride with Wes on Twitter asks, do you love or hate the Nissan Cube?
I love a lot about it, but I hate the seat.
It's not comfortable?
It's designed to feel like a sofa, and it does.
So it's not comfortable.
Yeah.
I haven't driven the Cube. I drove the original version, not the latest one that they've come out with yet. Okay, Zoyle asks, with the departure of Pontiac, will the bow tie pick up the slack in American Le Mans and Rolex? And these are racing questions, and you guys don't follow racing, right?
Not that much.
Yeah, no. We'll re-ask this when Peter DeLorenzo's back. Let's see. Elmer Bringus asks, any idea if the Lexus SC430's hardtop was designed in-house or licensed?
The SC430's hardtop?
Right.
Must have been licensed out because it sort of looks like a bathtub, and maybe American Standard did it. No, I don't know. I have no idea.
I don't either. I mean, typically Toyota does stuff in-house. I don't know if that means anything, but typically it does.
Yeah, they do. I can't see them outsourcing it.
Okay, Jim Geiger asks, what, in your opinions, are the keys for GM to successfully execute with four core brands and its remaining dealers going forward?
Try to simplify this. Obviously, Chevy has to be the volume brand, and they have to continue to do vehicles like the Malibu and the new Equinox and the Camaro, just execute them really well. Find select vehicles in there that you can really make a different Buick off of it. For some reason, people buy GMCs and think they're better than Chevys, even though the only difference is a front clip, so continue to make nice front clips and offer more stuff in the cabin, better options. And this one's really important. They've got to get the momentum back on Cadillac that they got a few years ago when the first CTS came out, because I think they've lost that momentum to a great degree. The new CTS is a great car, and the SRX looks really good, but they got to fill out that showroom. Yeah. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you got two vehicles that are relevant. They do well with Escalade, but it's not really all that relevant in this market.
I think they really have to find a place for Buick, and I don't know if they've found that yet.
Good question. Good point, I mean. Michael Banofsky asks, should GM sell cars via the Internet, and how? They announced this eBay thing. Talk about that.
Well, I mean, some of their dealers already do that. They list cars on eBay, and I don't think it's been all that successful for a lot of them, has it? Using the Internet to sell cars is... I didn't really understand what they were getting at, because there's nothing new there. I mean, there are people using the Internet in various ways to sell cars.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're just about at the top of the hour here, so we ought to wrap this up soon. But thank all of you for having tuned in. Remember, next week we're going to have Art Spinella from CNW Marketing. That'll be a fun show. After that, we've got Kurt Ritter from Saatchi & Saatchi, Toyota's advertising agency. He used to be with GM forever and ever. By the way, all this cool stuff that we've got, if you want to get it, besides winning it in contests, on the Autoline website right now at autolinedetroit.tv, we have got a store up where you can start buying this stuff if you're interested in doing that. Fair, we've got that up on the screen. You can get these different things. It's a cool part of our website that we just added. I want to congratulate our winners that we've got for the GM bankruptcy thing. Remember, too, you can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/autoline. You can follow Peter DeLorenzo, who will be back here next week, at twitter.com/autoextremist. Scott, you got anything that you
auto critic on Twitter?
Autocritic?
Oh, that's a great.
So that would be twitter.com/autocritic.
Yes.
Cool. And you've always got stuff on the Automotive News website, too. For
Detroit News website.
Detroit News, excuse me. Something News. But anyway, Scott Burgess, thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
And David Welch from Business Week, great having you here, too.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. By the way, I'm twitter.com/dwelch47.
Oh, okay.
And anybody that has a number next to it is late to the game there. So
it was actually a mistake I made.
You can change the name.
I tweet at least once a week, so I frankly don't find I'd rather blog than tweet. That's businessweek.com's autobeat blog.
Businessweek.com/ or what?
No, it's businessweek.com, and you
oh, go you go there.
Yeah, and there's a link on the homepage for blogs, and then you go to the Autobeat blog. Mm-hmm. And you can find out where David, Kylie, and I are on the mount.
I actually like Twitter only for photos, and I just talk about cars, so it frees up my Facebook page just to be my own.
Well, that's true. it does let you sort of keep that for social, get in touch with your old buddies from college or whatever.
That's great. Well, yeah, thanks, you guys.
Visit our website, autolinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern,
Get your daily automotive news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline Detroit. That's all there and much more at AutolineDetroit.tv. Orange, purple.